Hi folks, welcome to another one of our political chats. I'm joined by Dan, and today we're going to be talking about the scramble for narrative, because last week we did an episode of this, where we talked about how reform has gone down in the polls, and here is the Politico poll of polls, which undeniably shows that. And literally the next day, everyone was suddenly going on about, oh, reform's going down the polls, and that caused Nigel Farage to get angry at YouGov. because YouGov, one of the pollsters who were pitching reform quite low.
I've got a very similar story to that. Because you and Luke are always so well turned out, I thought I'm going to have to break out the suit with the waistcoat. So I got the suit with the waistcoat out of the cupboard, and I had to get angry with it because it had got smaller in the 10 years since I'd last worn it. But... I mean, quite realistically, I'm probably picking the wrong target there.
Hey man, if you can get that suit to change, that's exactly what's happening.
Maybe if I just verbally berated it enough, it would get bigger, or whatever.
That is exactly the theme of today's episode. So as you can see, it's not just. YouGov, obviously. Here's one from Techni, which I'm not even familiar with, to be honest. Here's one from More in Common, -2, -3. And so you've got this general trend of, well, actually, things are kind of going a bit south.
Your first one was polar polls, wasn't it?
So it was encompassing all of them. So it covers them all.
Because I remember we discussed this last week, and it was kind of at that sort of inflection week, a week back. And
it's been fairly consistent.
Where did we talk about it last week? Where were we?
It was literally only about here, I think.
Oh, okay.
So it's I mean, you know, ups and downs, but it's been pretty low.
Oh, the trend is in.
Yeah.
I mean, that is looking like a red ski route.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong, like we keep talking about, it's not good news for anyone else.
No.
Labour, Conservative and Greens on about 18-16%, and of course Lib Dems are in their perennial 12% bracket.
Well, the British public doesn't know who to vote for. They just know that all their options are bad.
Yes, that's basically it. And you've got like a core of the population, which are probably boomers, who like Nigel Farage because he reminds him of their childhood going on holiday to Butlins. Anyway, so we've got the polls, which are all of these polls are actually really quite consistent. Like Reform on 27, Conservatives 18, Labour 17, Greens 17, Lib Dem 14. Mm-hmm. Like if you compare that to the average of the polls, yeah, that's pretty much within a margin of error.
Yep.
That's within a point or two of all of them. So that seems to be a fairly reliable thing.
Our political system is just not built for this. This is a proper mess for the British system.
Agreed. And it's, again, the same. I mean, maybe this one's overestimating the Greens, but the Greens are on 16 on average. You know, having the Greens only on 13 is actually quite low from More in Common. So who knows? Right? Who knows? So anyway, like I said, Nigel Farage decided he was going to have a war with YouGov because they were consistently polling... polling him around 22-23%. And that was damaging to his ego, I suppose. Because he says here, I'm pleased that YouGov have backed down and will follow British Polling Council rules. We can now see the full extent of how they manipulate their data to suppress reform.
So what does he mean by back down? I mean, what?
Well, we'll get into that in a second, Dan.
Okay.
Let's first talk about them manipulating their data to suppress reform.
Okay.
So this is from the Times article, right? And basically all this comes down to is a leading pollster has agreed to publish more data behind its results after Nigel Farage accused it of underplaying the popularity of reform. YouGov, whose voter intention surveys are published in the Times, has consistently placed the party lower than rival pollsters, and this is because it questions people on how they are likely to vote in their own constituency rather than which party they favour in general. And YouGov have a good reason to do this.
But hang on, that genuinely has an enormous impact on the results.
And it also more accurately models what will happen at a general election.
I mean, I can give a brilliant example of this. Gorton and Denton, right? Okay, if Reform are polling at 50% in Gorton, that means they are going to win every seat in the country. If they're polling at 50% in Denton... maybe they scrape through, maybe they get a hung parliament.
You know what's interesting? We've got those numbers in.
Oh, you do?
Okay.
Are they in this stack?
Well, they are in this stack.
Okay.
And it's weird how prescient how that example actually is.
Yes, because one is an Islamic haven.
Yep.
And the other one is the ethnic British.
Yep.
And if you don't take into account whether you're getting your 50% in Gorton or Denton, it tells you nothing about the UK as a whole.
We'll come to that. But that's okay. Exactly. But that's it. No. It's exactly. You're exactly on point. Right. In fact, this Guido Fawkes have for some reason decided to turn into a reform campaign arm.
He's always a bit behind the curve, is Guido.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I'd want them as my campaigners. But anyway, the point is they've got this article. Well, I mean, generously call it an article, where you can see they're like, well, hang on a second. If we have YouGov essentially redo their methodology, then as you can see...
Until we win.
And that's literally what's happening.
Yes.
Right. The established way that YouGov works has cost Reform 2.4 points, the Greens 2.1 points, and the Lib Dems go up by 2.7, and the Conservatives up by 2.1. If you go for their, what I suppose they would accuse of being massage data...
Wait.
If you look at the raw data... Actually, Reform is slightly up, and the Conservatives and Lib Dems are slightly down.
So Nigel just basically wants to go on the raw data because he looks better on the raw data?
Correct. Okay. That's literally what this is.
I mean, in addition to my point about it matters enormously who's answering and where they're answering, the other factor is that if you're a Reform voter, I mean, Reform is basically the TV party.
Yeah.
Everything they do is how can I appeal to TV watchers? Boomers. And so those are the people who are far more likely to actually respond to polls and do things. The people who vote for Greens, they're all...
in a city.
They either don't speak English or they're students.
Yeah.
And they're doing something else other than responding to polls.
But also, the reason the Greens are an Islamo-Communist alliance... Mm. is because it represents the people who live in the dense urban areas. Mm. Right. The Islamic types are like, okay, we just want Gibbs. And the communists are just like, we want Gibbs as well. Because communists are complaining about their rent and how they'll never buy a house. And so they want communism to essentially give them a house. And, well, if you're just looking for handouts from the state, well, yeah, you'd join the Greens too.
Yeah, communists.
So you can see how actually there is a kind of economic sense behind the Green Party. Mm. It's just parasitic.
Well, yeah. I like them in one respect, that they are identifiably a anti-establishment party. You can't accuse them of being establishment.
Yeah, that's true. They've gone way further to the left than the establishment ever would dare.
Yeah.
Which is useful, actually, because what it shows you, the great thing about watching the Greens and Labour argue is that it's always about ideological purity, right? The Labour Party will say, we want what the Greens want, we just can't get there because that will break the entire system. And the Greens therefore say, oh, you don't really want what we want then, because we're trying to break the entire system. And the Labour Party, being currently the party of government, are like, no, we have to take things very seriously.
Yeah.
And the Green Party, never having been a party of government, with people like Carla Denyer, Mothen Ali and Zach Polanski, are a student politics government of fantasy communism.
It's sitting at home playing I Wish.
But exactly.
And actually, I mean, all of Labour's problems so far have come from the fact that in their first year, I mean, when they weren't screwing up on the Southport response and stuff like that, they were actually trying to do one or two sensible things in the background. And every time their own backbenchers basically kicked up enormous fuss about it, and they had to retreat on it.
Well, I mean, this is especially prescient and prevalent in what Shabana Mahmood is trying to do.
Yes.
Shabana Mahmood is actually trying to do something sensible.
Oh, she's well to the right of the last 14 years of Conservative Home Secretary.
Absolutely. And it's what's causing, I think, a massive spike in the Green Party membership. Mm. Shabana Mahmood is saying, look, we want rules-based immigration.
Yeah.
Well,
why would you want any rules about immigration? I mean,
if you were part of the Islamic coalition in the Green Party, that's not desirable in any way.
Yep.
So anyway, as you can see, the what they want is essentially a low-resolution view of the data that YouGov have.
Okay.
So this is like the sort of thing they'll end up publishing. So, well, Reform are on 29%. And again, it's roughly in line with the polling, but it shows Reform a bit higher than normal. Now, YouGov have said, no, we're not doing any of that, actually. A headline in this morning's Times is inaccurate, and they have issued this correction. YouGov is not making changes to its methodology or to its previously published results. We are happy to make this clear. We are not changing our methodology or results, which accurately predicted the Reform vote at the 2024 general election.
And that's pretty solid as an explanation.
what is the point of polling is the question that is being attacked here, right? What do you want from the polling? Do you want an accurate view of what the country thinks and what it is, or do you think that polling leads opinion and therefore having high polling means that essentially it's a big ego boost for your party when you're swaggering around?
So the last election, I will admit, a number of the pollsters came reasonably close, but we had had a period before that of a good 10 years where the polls were just all over the place, and they didn't really tell you much. And the conversation was starting to be had, why do we bother with opinion polls?
Yeah.
And a lot of people were saying, well, actually, they're there to lead opinion. And this is, I mean, this is an old...
There's definitely a conventional wisdom in that, right?
Yes.
The establishment thinks that actually, yeah, and Farage is basically taking the mask off and admitting to this by attacking YouGov. He's saying, no, the poll is here to lead opinion. What are you doing? I'm ahead in 200 plus polls, blah, blah, blah. But sorry, Karen.
There's an old George Soros, when he was, because I know he's evil now, but he used to be really good at finance.
Oh, yeah.
And he developed this whole model called reflexivity, which
that doesn't
is...
mean he's not evil. Then.
Oh, yeah, no, you could be good at finance and evil. No,
I imagine it's
quite often they go together.
Actually,
they're complementary skills, I'll give you that. But his reflexivity model was it's not reality, you then get perception. What it is your perception changes your actions, which then changes reality, and it just feeds back in on itself. And clearly what Farage wants is, because he has lost his organic momentum...
Yes.
He wants to inorganically appear like he's still got momentum.
I think that's a really great way of putting it. Because it sorry about my throat. It seems that Farage is essentially capped out on his personal and reforms appeal.
Yeah.
About 33%. I think that was the high point. And I think
it was the highest it got, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Like, if we go back to poll of polls, it was 30, somewhere in the
I remember seeing a 33% at some point, but
they, I mean, there are polls that are above, but on average, sort of like 31%, and that roughly tracks with public approval of Farage. His personal personal approval is about a third, personal disapproval is about two thirds, and there's a very thin slither of people in the middle who don't know. So Farage doesn't really have much more ground to be able to capture, because everyone knows who he is, and you either like him or you hate him. He's like Marmite to a lot of people.
I mean, in normal times, that wouldn't be enough to win, but when you've got another five parties and they're all splitting the vote all over the place, he could actually get in with that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's, like I said, he's still more popular than Keir Starmer, right? So So going back to this, YouGov have said, no, we're not changing our methodology. We're not backing down on our data. And even if they say, well, look, we are going to publish more data, as in we will. So what they've done here is just published the previous unprocessed raw data.
Right.
Say, okay, well, you can see the raw data if you want. There's nothing exciting or exceptional about it.
But we don't stand by that because it's not.
Because it doesn't actually tell you the reality of what's happening in the country. And Patrick English here says, look, we don't obviously make tactical adjustments or anything. Mm. And maybe they do, maybe they don't. I've got no particular reason to trust YouGov other than their record, right? So let's talk about what the actual bonus was. When they ended up redoing their polls, well, Reform got a +2 bump in the polls, which puts them in line with their polling average. So all of this hassle just for YouGov themselves to be like, yeah, you're on 25%. Mm. Okay, Nigel, is that sufficient? That's not a general election win. We talked about this last week. You can't win a general election on 25%.
No.
So what good did this do you?
No, you're just the first person who gets a chance to form a coalition.
With the Conservatives.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what I thought we'd do is talk about MRP polling. Right? Okay. So this is electoral calculus who are going to tell us, because this is the method, the statistical method, which not just YouGov, many of them actually use MRP polling because it is an advanced statistical method. Don't shoot me if I get any of this wrong, by the way. I'm not a statistician. I'm reading what they're telling me of getting more granular information out of the data. Right. So as electoral calculus tell us, MRP stands for multi-level regression and post-stratification, which is a relatively new polling technique and has outperformed conventional polling methods in recent elections. Conventional polling methods often apply a uniform national swing, some abbreviated as a UNS, approach to predict how many seats a party will win in an election. The UNS approach assumes assumes there will be the same change in vote share for a given party evenly throughout the country. And you can already see why this would give inaccurate results. Given if we had a more homogenous country, maybe this would make sense.
So that process sounds absolutely brilliant when every election is
between the Labour and Conservatives,
Tories, maybe the Lib Dems.
Yep.
Because you know what you're getting year after year after year. I used to watch on the Parliament channel when I still watch TV. They do reruns on every bank holiday of past elections, and you could watch them back. And year after year, it was the same script. It was the same process. But now we've got at least, was it three or four new parties?
Oh, yeah. Loads. Yeah. A significant
part. And the landscape has just fractured, so...
But moreover, like, if you've... I mean, if you go back to, say, an election in 1992, what does the country actually look like? The country basically looks the same as it did in 1870.
Yes.
Demographically, the country hasn't changed. The locations of industry are still broadly the same, whether they're up or down. Fine, you know, okay, you know, industry's suffering, but it's still located in the same places. Well, where's the agriculture going on? Well, the agriculture's going on in the same places. Okay, well, where's the commerce going on? Well, it's the same place as it was 100 years ago.
Yep.
And so if you've got demographically the same people and logistically the same country, yeah, you can just use the old-fashioned polling methods that will give you a broad but assumingly what assumes a homogenous country to make to bring in that data. Yeah, so that
and all of those assumptions that you just made have been unwound for various reasons. Is massive migration, work from home, I mean, a whole bunch of things.
Well, there's so much to think about. Like, I mean, industry. I mean, does anyone talk about British industry anymore? What industry do we even have left? Right,
I presume you've got some.
Well, I know there is actually some in London and Manchester, but it's not nearly like it was. We don't have, you know, the steelworks, we have coal mining. Mm. We don't have the demographic homogeneity that we used to have. I mean, if you look at just, I didn't get it up for this, but if you look at just the map of the ethnicities and concentrations of ethnicities in this country, they're wildly different. Mm. Then you've got different economic outcomes. For example, a lot of the Southeast is now a lot richer than they would have been 50 or 70 years ago, right, post-Thatcher. So you've got all of these sorts of changes where actually you don't have the reliable country you thought you had before.
No. And so you don't have the country you wish we had.
Absolutely. I mean, I would love to have that old, reliable country where the politics was boring and stale and only actually talked about incredibly dim issues.
Well, I remember 30 years ago, the things that used to be considered newsworthy. I want that world back.
I know.
Now, every day, it's, another child has been senselessly assaulted, and it's...
A murder or something terrible like that, yeah. But no, you're absolutely right, I want that world back as well. But the point being, right, is that the uniform national swing no longer has the kind of predictive power that it had, right? Because, as they say, it assumes that the same change in vote share will be uniform across the country for each party. But this doesn't happen in practice. And they give us some examples of why that doesn't happen. And they point out that these differences are not captured by UNS. Therefore, the model can overestimate the performance of parties in some areas and underestimate it in others. So the MRP method, the multi-regression post-stratification method, tries to solve this by working out the relationship between people's voting intentions and their individual demographic characteristics like age, income, educational background, obviously ethnicity is going to be in there.
Whether they got off the boat 2 weeks ago.
And a variety of other data sources, including past voting behavior. Then you can count how many of these different types of voters are in each constituency to make a prediction of how the parties will perform on a seat-by-seat basis, which is just saying we're using the data that we have, which is more voluminous than just what do you think. That can actually be mapped to previous data that we have and can be granularly applied to the constituency based on the demographic profile of each constituency, which is relevant now, or a lot more relevant than it used to be, because as we've covered this before, if you go through the 2021 census map and you just search for ethnicity and you flip through the different ethnicities, you'll notice that there's Pakistanis here, Indians here, Africans here, Caribbeans here. Like, it's not...
It's a strong clustering effect.
Exactly. It's very different in each place. And so it's necessary to have some more advanced statistical rendering of what's actually happening, or else you don't know.
Yeah, I mean, what they described, I mean, I had some idea it was basically that, but I can't see how else you would do it until AIs just take over and do it for us.
And why wouldn't you? If you had the ability to have more advanced statistical analysis of the country that is actually more maps more accurately than merely the sort of, you know, again, it's like a low resolution, well, Britain entirely thinks this. It's like, okay, but that's not, we don't vote for presidents, right?
Yes.
That's again, it seems to be the Yankification of reform, where it's just like, yeah, but if I'm in the polls, I'm going to win. It's like, no.
I mean, this all just comes back to my view that the reform is mentally stuck in 1995. They want to watch their TVs, stay in 1995, do their Bingo Butlin style presentations, and just assume that nothing's changed. But
and don't get me wrong, my soul is there too. but unfortunately, we are not there. And so the question is, well, is this a good model? Does it work? And the answer is, well, what do you mean by good? Right? I hate to get old Jordan Peterson about this.
Well, does it have predictive power?
Well, that's what you want.
Oh, right.
Is that what Nigel Farage wants?
Right.
And the answer is, it appears not, right? There appears to be a divergence of opinion here.
Yeah.
Nigel Farage wants a number that shows him to be high in the polls so he can swagger and say, leading all the polls, bro.
Ah,
but
right.
If you do want predictive power, which is what YouGov brag their model does, then this is what you would want. You would want the more granular post-MRP process.
Yep, makes sense.
Rather than the low resolution number. Now, look at some of the things that YouGov point out from the 2024 election. So this has only been 2 years, right? So this is going to be the best possible proof of whether this works.
Yep.
And YouGov point out that they were actually the most accurate in terms of seats and the second most accurate for overall vote share. They say, our larger MRP model performed strongly at the election. It was the most accurate MRP model in terms of seats, calling 92% of constituencies correctly. That's pretty good. None of the others got that good.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it speaks for itself, doesn't it?
Exactly. 92%. Like, sorry, if you're actually looking for accurate data, this is the thing you want. If you're looking to have a headline of
yes.
ego boost, and so you can bluff your way through to the next election, well, then you want the unprocessed data.
Well, 6 months ago, Nigel Farage didn't need to get his headlines via this method.
We'll come to that in a minute as well.
Right.
So they say this was better than all of the other MRP models and marginally better than the famously accurate BBC ITV Sky exit poll.
Oh, well, that is a higher standard because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the exit polls are pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
The exit polls are genuinely one of the most useful things. We know because we keep covering elections live as they happen.
Yes.
The exit polls are very important. Quite looking forward to the next one of those we do, actually, because they're always fun.
I wonder how long that
absolutely. In terms of national vote shares, our MRP model was the second most accurate out of the final polls and MRPs. The average error on party shares was 1.4%.
I wish I could make investments with a 1.4% error rate.
That's right. I mean, like, I wish I did anything that had a 1.4% error rate.
Yeah.
So they talk about some of some of their failings. So they will explain that, well, we overestimated how many people would swing. They could prove there was a swing from Labour to Conservatives, but they overestimated certain things and they underestimated certain things because, frankly, you don't know until after the thing has been done. But generally, and they underestimated Conservative loyalists as well, because remember, Rishi Sunak got 126 seats, something like that. But the polling, and it wasn't just YouGov, it was everywhere. The polling was like, oh God, the Conservatives are going to get like 40, 30 seats, which is why we ran the zero seat stream, right? Mm. Now, it's probably because a bunch of boomers just didn't show up in polling. And they just go out and vote Conservative every single time. And so it's not that this is perfect, but it is the gold standard of polling in Britain.
I mean, what you're saying is, okay, show me something better, and you can't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There just isn't something better other than the election itself.
Mm.
It's even better than the exit polling, which is usually brilliant. So anyway, this would have been good to know, as you were saying, at the Gorton and Denton by-election. So as you can see, 69% of the ethnic minorities voted for the Greens, 24, said they voted for Labour. Now, they would have previously voted overwhelmingly for Labour, but the Labour Party completely lost them. Only 5% of them voted for reform. This is quite important, isn't it?
That is. The first thing that jumps out at me is notice how the ethnic minorities are not confused about who's going to butter their bread for them.
Absolutely not.
I mean, some of them are still in the Labour mindset, and they will get benefits from the Labour, from Labour, but they're clearly going to get more, and 69% of them have received the memo. Yep. And I'm pretty sure the other 24, if they properly understood, that they would get more Gibbs from the Greens. Well, all of that would get...
Just a quick thing on that. I watched videos from Gorton and Denton in the Gorton side of Muslims saying, yeah, I'm just going to stick with Labour. I don't think Greens are going to get it. So it wasn't that they didn't think they'd get the Gibbs. It was
purely
like,
tactical.
Who do you think is going to give you the Gibbs?
But I mean, that community is just straight up, this is resource extraction.
Yep.
This is the way to get it done. They're not confused. They're not, their thinking is obviously not muddled by sentiment and notions. Look at the whites, though.
Well, Ham, before we go on to the whites, how much does Nigel Farage genuflect towards ethnic minorities?
Oh, God. Yeah, that's a good point. All of that pandering that he's been doing for the last 5, the pandering that has caused him to exorcise from the movement the entire online right,
yep.
You know, an enormous amount of his own activists, even some of his own MPs, certainly people that he's worked with. He's done all that purging, all that going on Steve Edgington and saying, no, it's impossible to do anything about immigration. He went through all of that for 5%.
I wouldn't lift a finger for 5% of a vote if I were him. I'd be like, well, okay, where's our constituency? It's like, well, you're going to get, you know, 46% of one and you get 5% of the other. I'd be like, okay, well, let's just work on the one we've got strength in. Why, you know, the fact they got 5% is, come on, man, that's...
And what are we at this point? Are we like a 76% white country, something in that region?
Probably less. Probably about 70%.
Okay, so let's say we're a 70% white country. He has done everything that he's done. He's alienated the vast swathes of the right for 5% of 30%.
Yes.
Whatever that is. That is...
You're the mathematician, not me.
Well, it's not a big number.
It's not a very big number at all, no.
like 2% or something.
My gut feeling is, don't bother, mate. Right? Like, this was not something that actually, and as you say, watering down his message, making it non-nativist, has really hurt him. Bringing in a bunch of Tories who were the immigration Tories, who were in government literally doing the immigration at the time, and then putting Muslims in positions of... as the sort of face of the party to say, look, I'm not a racist. We're going to bring all these Muslims and minorities, want them to vote for us too. Didn't work. Right? None of it worked.
I mean, I admit occasionally he manages to take a photo with some Sikhs or something.
Yeah, okay,
fine.
Great. I mean, and that probably is that 5%.
Yes.
Because remember, we went through the Gorton and Denton numbers and there were like 400 Sikhs in that seat.
Oh, okay, well, there we go. He got them then.
Yeah, okay, great. Well done. Obviously, the Sikhs didn't vote with the Muslims, but like...
Maybe you could not alienate your own base, the entire online right, and then just, you know, be nice to the Sikhs, and maybe it would get you the same outcome, except you wouldn't have pissed away your own support base. You wouldn't have alienated the natives.
Well, exactly. And, the Sikhs would have come with you anyway.
Because they would have done, yeah, because the Sikhs are under no illusions what it means for them if the Muslims take over.
Exactly. They're not stupid. And this is why I get frustrated with the online right being like, he's got a Sikh there. It's like, yeah, but the Sikhs are pretty good conservative people, morally upstanding by and large.
Yeah.
Obviously, they have problems and everyone has problems, but like, they're not an intrinsically hostile group. Right. So, okay, what's the problem? You know, who cares? But anyway, let's go over to the white side.
Yes.
So Nigel Farage has got 46% there. Now that's quite a lot. That's not quite half, but like you were guessing, you know, if you're half of this, no, you didn't get half of that, but that's pretty good, but it's not enough. And they would have all basically been ex-Labour voters. Because remember, the Conservatives only ever had like 7% in this seat anyway, right? So what did you do? You sent a Tory-coded southeast academic to go be the candidate?
Yes.
It's like,
doing his best Alan Partridge impression the entire way.
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, I don't hate Matt Goodwin or anything, you know, but, like, he just wasn't the guy. Matt Goodwin should have been campaigning in Surrey or Sussex or something like that, right? Not in Gorton and Denton. And also, why did you fill your party with Tories? Do you think they're natural Tory voters?
My concern with the outcome of Gorton and Denton is that Nigel Farage's key takeaway is that he should have run a Pakistani or an Urdu guy.
I mean, that might well be his, key takeaway, actually.
And the other thing is, if you add up, okay, yeah, they got 40%, 6%, which is fine.
Yeah.
If you add up the white population who are like, no, please tax me into oblivion and send all my resources to the invaders group, that's actually 48%.
Yeah. It's actually more of them.
So the white population have not kind of understood what time it is.
Yes. And moreover, you failed to convert them. Right. You failed to say, like, I've got your guy right here.
Yeah.
Right. I've got your guy. So that 46% is probably lower than it would have been. I don't think Matt Goodwin did run a very good campaign.
No.
I think he himself is just the wrong kind of person to run in that seat.
Well, again, I mean, I watched what he was doing. He was either blasting at people through a megaphone or attacking the online right. It's like, what? Can you just get off the.
But it was also very negative, right? He was not like, here's what we're going to do for the country.
Yeah.
Here's what they are going to do to the country. And it's like, well, I mean,
yes.
They live in a constituency that's 30%+ Muslim. They know what they're going to do to the country. How did you not persuade them that you were for them? I mean, that 46%, okay, you've got a good solid protest vote there, about half of them in a protest vote.
Yep.
But how is it you failed to convert any of the rest of them?
And Hannah Spencer did have a positive message. She wasn't spending a lot of time talking about reform. I can't remember seeing any clips where she talked about reforms. I'm sure she did it, but I didn't see them. She was all about, this is what we're going to do for you. This is how we're going to make your life better. Now, all of it is fantasy Marxist economics, complete fantasy, but it was a positive message.
It's a message. And you're exactly right. And also, she's a local lass, right? Mm. You know, she's from the area. She had a message. And she trounced you with it.
Mm. Like
5,000 votes higher than you.
Oh, yeah, was...
These absolute numbers...
It wasn't close.
No, that was 10,000 for Matt Goodwin and 15,000 for Hannah. So the white Labour and Green vote, that's... I mean, that's probably about 10,000. In fact, we know that's probably about 11,000, actually. So that's 48%. Matt Goodwin got 10,000. Yeah. Like, we know that basically he didn't... He barely got half the constituency.
I mean, we keep talking about...
Of the white British.
About what's going to happen when we get to, you know, majority-minority. Well, we're cooked.
Yeah, we're cooked, yeah. Because, like, there are lots of the white British who are just not paying attention to the issue.
Yeah.
And
the other side will just be full extraction.
Yeah. I mean, one of the only upsides to this is that MPs don't actually have any power.
Well, yeah.
This is literally the only thing they can do is essentially advocate in Parliament, and like you said, it's the power of patronage, rather than actual.
But I mean, the Home Office has a massive Islamic network, so
absolutely, yeah. And doubtless, Hannah the plumber. Will,
I mean, there were multiple fronts we get to lose on.
Yes,
yeah.
But when it comes to like direct executive authority, MPs don't have any.
No, that's
so
true.
That is at least, you know, something positive that's come out of this, Gorton and Denton.
I mean, that's actually the one thing I would say for Restore is if you can't find 650 top flight candidates, don't worry about it. Just find 650 candidates and then appoint every minister you need through the Lords, which you can do.
Assuming Keir Starmer leaves anything of the Lords standing by the time
the
next election comes along.
You can always bring
it
back if you need to, but yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, so the point is that when you're attacking the pollsters... No, that's a bad sign, right?
It's all a bit Joffrey, isn't it?
Yeah. I was reading this Substack about this, and there's a good point in this where a Labour MP and former opinion pollster Chris Curtis said to Politico, "In my decade in polling, I could always tell when a party was on the ropes because they start lashing out at the pollsters rather than speaking to the voters. Nigel Farage is just the latest to look at a bad poll and decide the fault lies with the tape measure and not the waistline, as you put it."
I kind of got there early, but
you,
yep.
You did, but that's exactly. Yep. And that's precisely the point.
Mm.
Where's the red meat, Nigel? Right, that's...
Well, it's explicitly off the table.
And it's explicitly off the table for 5%.
Yep.
Like, no, we won't have any red meat.
Because like 5% of Sikhs who probably would have voted for him anyway.
Exactly, and who probably would have appreciated the red meat too.
Yeah, right? Yes.
Yeah. Like, because, again, this is the thing. Like,
shock horror, people tend to vote in their interest, unless they're white.
Yeah, and for many of the non-Muslim minorities, not having a Muslim majority is definitely in their interest.
Mm.
They definitely feel this way. And I've spoken to plenty of them.
Mm.
They are happy that, that's what they expected when they came here.
Yes.
But the point being, and I think this is the really important point, is what do you think this victory has achieved, Nigel, right? Mm. Because, okay, let's say...
Sorry, what victory?
Well, the victory over YouGov. Right.
Ah.
Making YouGov roll back to the low resolution data. What did that achieve? Well, what that's done is clouded your own vision, right? You now have a less accurate map of the world in your mind and how your party is doing and how they are likely to do. Because, complaining, if you actually break it down and granulate it to constituency level, reform goes down and the Lib Dems go up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everyone in British politics is aware of this because the Lib Dems are famous for their ground game, and their ground game specifically targets those majority white, majority English, middle class, well-to-do areas, because they know that's who they're appealing to. They know their constituency. And that's why the Southwest is very heavily Lib Dem. And they've got 60 MPs or 80 MPs at the moment. So they know, we're not going to go canvass in the northeast of England.
Yes.
Right? We're not going to canvass in Bradford. Right? We're not going to canvass in...
Because people there don't have big gardens, so what's the point?
Well, exactly. Right? Exactly. We know who our constituents are.
Even 20 years ago, simply taking the raw data from the national averages and working out the Lib Dem support would have been a nonsense, because they have always been a localised party.
Yes. And so, the Lib Dems are on 12%. Yes, I'm sure in North Wales, the Lib Dems are only getting, or probably not even getting 12%. But that's why you don't want to just apply the national statistic to the entire country and go, I guess the Lib Dems aren't getting any seats now then. No, they're going to get about 80 seats.
But this is also utterly elementary. There's no way that somebody like Nigel Farage can spend a lifetime in politics and not know everything that we're saying.
You would think, yeah.
Well,
I'm sure he does.
I think he understands it. I just think he's scrambling for narrative.
I think that's exactly the problem. And so, but the problem, as Chris Curtis pointed out, is that look, if you're scrambling for narrative, you're supposed to be setting that as the party leader.
And
this is why we're sick of the Tories and their red meat.
You can accuse Nigel Farage of many things, but being a leader is most certainly not one of them.
Being ahead of the curve is not it.
No.
That's correct, yeah.
Normally, he spends all day long trying to find people to fire because they're 1 inch to the right of him.
Yeah, because they were a day ahead of him.
Until he eventually ends up adopting that position, or restore take it first and then he has to steal it.
Yeah.
Guy's not a leader.
Which is exactly his problem. Mm. And that's exactly why he's lashing out now. Because, really, Nigel Farage should be just coming out with some hardline right-wing policies. That's what you should be coming out with. Look, you know who your constituency is. Mm. Your constituency is the white working class who feel insecure because of immigration, right? Mm. So you should be coming out with hard anti-immigration statements. If you want to go up in those polls, that's what you need to do. You also need to make sure you don't look like a goddamn Tory. Now, that's going to be really difficult. It's going to be really, really difficult. Now you've crammed your party, literally, as we went through the Wikipedia page the other day, with 100 Tories. That's going to be really tough. A really tough sell. Now, you've made your choice. You may have locked yourself on rails that are going forward. Mm. You've got to think about that, right? You've got to think about the decisions you made.
As we talked about before, there is a gulf between what reform voters think that reform are offering and what Nigel Farage is actually offering.
Yes.
If he wants to work out what to do, what he should do is get some focus group of reform voters and say to them, what do you think reform are going to do? But the whole schism with the online right is that we do actually pay attention to what he says he's going to do, and we can see the gap.
And we pay attention to what he doesn't actually do. When he stands up and says, I'm going to conduct a private rape gang inquiry, and doesn't do it.
Yes.
And then Rupert Lowe does it.
Whereas the reason why he's still on whatever it is, 25%, is because most guys who are planning to vote for reform, they get up early in the morning, They go to work, they work hard, they come home, they've got a few hours, sit with the wife, watch the TV, have dinner, and then they go to bed. They don't, they're not like us. They don't have time to watch this stuff. So they don't realise that there was this massive gap between expectations and the actual reform. That's why the online right have split from him, because we're just seeing it.
Yes, everyone thinks reform's going to be a nativist party.
Yeah.
It's not a nativist party. And so what now? Nigel Farage needs to think about what his voters are abandoning him from.
I mean, there's real danger that he's going to go into the next election. I know he said that at the next election, Robert Jenrick is going to be to the right of me. There's real danger that Shabana Mahmood is going to be to the right of him at the next election.
I mean, she seems more hardline.
Yes.
Her rhetoric on immigration has been harder than his.
Yeah.
So, and I believe it as well. I believe Shabana Mahmood, because we'll get into that in a bit, because we've got some more, because we'll talk about Labour for a little bit as well, just because we haven't mentioned Labour in a while, and they are the government, so it's probably worth bringing.
We forget, but yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so the point being, Nigel Farage is failing to actually engage with the voters. By attacking the pollsters, he is essentially saying, someone pull wool over my eyes. I don't want to be properly informed, or I don't want the public to be properly informed about what the state of play actually is.
Yes.
It's like, okay, Nigel, you need that so you can turn the ship around. Mm. Right, saying, no, I'm sick of this spyglass that's showing me an iceberg in the distance is not sufficient. But then, you know, I guess this would be advice if I wanted him to win, which I don't particularly. Anyway, so this disconnect also exists in the Labour Party. Oh, there was this as well. I forgot to bring this up. This disconnect also exists in the Labour Party, right? So this is a pollster called James, I can't pronounce that, who has pointed out that actually 50% of people are changing their vote in every election now. Because we have had so many rapid elections in quick succession in the last decade. I think from like 2017 to now, we've had like four elections. It's a lot, right? Mm. We've had a bunch of different prime ministers that we didn't necessarily elect. And so now the system's up in the air and it's all changed. And 50% of the public are like, I don't know who I'm going to vote.
Well, and also it's not just the elections that are coming fast. The betrayals are coming faster now as well. Because the establishment has decided, we're not even going to slow roll it anymore. We are just going to bundle as many people in as we possibly can, as fast as we can. So there's not even the illusion of how surprising all these people turned up. It's just a absolute gunning it.
We'll get to that in a minute as well. Yeah. So this reinforces it is not the country it used to be, right? As in, it used to be that you knew, like again with the universal polling, you knew a Labour, I mean, there are constituencies in this country that have gone green and conservative under Boris, and green, and now I guess a lot of them will go reform, and that have always been Labour. Mm. Since the creation of the constituency, this has always been, and Gordon and Denton was one of them, right? And now it's gone green. So not only have the Conservatives failed to make any gains there, the Labour Party have lost something that they never thought they'd lose. I mean, they call it the Red Wall or whatever, because they thought it was essentially unbreakable.
And we're not like America. When you say since the constituency is formed, a lot of them were formed in the 1870s.
Yeah. I mean, literally 100-plus years.
Yes.
Right? So these since the advent of democracy in this country, this constituency has voted for the Labour Party or something that, you know, prior to that was on the same page. But now half the people in the country are just like, oh, I might vote for this, might vote for that. So everything's to play for, actually. If you're a new party, everything's to play for. And that's why, honestly, you can't, like, you know, obviously I don't agree with the Greens on anything, but you can't fault the energy with which they're campaigning.
Right? Well, it's working.
Exactly. It's working for them. Yeah. And they're not, they're one of the least clownish parties in politics, actually. Right, you've got Hannah the plumber and the Muslim.
And she does dress like a child's.
She does dress like a child's entertainer. She is dancing around at the by-election. Yes. Okay, but you know they're all clowns. Is it Ed Davey? Is it, you know, Nigel Farage's?
He is more clownish. I'll give you that.
Carnival show. You know, anyway, you know, in a sea of clowns. Mm. You know, the Greens. Zach Polanski himself is one of the least clownish. If you see Zach Polanski, he's got his rhetoric, and you'd agree with it or disagree with it, but he's dressed like a normal person, and he's just sat there. This is what the Greens will do. Right.
Every time I watch anything from the Greens, I think two thoughts. One, that's ridiculous and won't work.
Yeah.
And two, you've messaged that quite well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. He's good at his message.
The right needs an answer to the Green approach because it works.
Yeah, and the right. Well, I think they have someone now who's got that sort of approach. But
yes.
Anyway, so the Labour Party are having a massive crisis at the moment where they scramble for narrative too. This happened today where Angela Rayner came out and was like, yes, by the way, Labour's immigration reforms risk being un-British, which is just a remarkable thought on the face of it.
So letting in less immigration
is un-British.
Would be un-British.
Extending indefinite leave to remain is un-British.
That's some mirror universe shit right there.
Yeah. But it shows you why so many people have defected to the Greens. Because they're the ones who all agree. And Angela Rayner is in the sort of soft left space that's kind of, they can feel the tidal pull towards the Greens because of these arguments.
Yes.
Whereas Shabana Mahmood is actually on the sort of hard right of the Labour Party, which is like, no, we're going to have law and order. We're going to have rules. Mm. And again, this is Shabana Mahmood is pretty hard line on these things.
Yeah.
And that's what this will come
more so
from.
Than Nigel Farage.
And every Conservative. And the Conservatives Nigel Farage took into his party. Ministers want to double the amount of time that it takes migrant workers to qualify for permanent residence from 5 to 10 years, which Conservatives could have done. Well, they just couldn't have brought them in. And in the case of refugees, it could take 20 years. And so Angela Rayner's like, well, that's un-British. Is it? You know? Anyway. She also talks about how the very survival of the Labour Party is at stake, saying that they're running out of time. And this is the headline that the Telegraph went with, which is not wrong. I think they are running out of time, actually. Andy Burnham came out to support us. You can see the sort of the coalition that Labour had patched together is now completely splitting apart. So Angela Rayner represented, well, essentially the northern working class, right? Yes. She's herself like a northerner, Andy Burnham.
Yes.
She's the sort of person who should have been running in Gorton and Denton. I mean, not her personally, but like, you know, that kind of person, you know, not brilliantly educated, comes authentically from that community, comes from the sort of blue Labour tradition almost, the sort of like, you know, we're not radical screeching hysterical leftists, right? We're not going to sit and lecture you about trans rights or whatever. We're going to agree to it all, obviously.
Yes.
But that's not our primary concern. Our primary concern is making sure that essentially capitalism doesn't gut our communities. Right. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
You know, they're the sort of people who are now switching to reform. Starmer, representing the managerial technocracy and the continuation of Tony Blair's Labour, which is wearing the Labour Party as a skin suit.
Yes.
She is now in direct challenge to him. But remember that Starmer blocked Andy Burnham. So Angela Rayner's sort of path.
And saved his career in the process.
We'll talk about Starmer's wins in a minute, actually.
I mean, bear in mind, we had this whole conversation about the Greens versus Reform in Gorton and Denton. I paid no attention. That Labour did not feature. And the whole conversation where Andy Burnham was going for it is that he could win it. They weren't, what were they, third or something?
Yeah, they were third. And Andy Burnham might well have been able to win it. He's popular in Manchester. No. He's from the area.
Yeah.
Like, he would have been the best possible candidate. But Keir Starmer saw him rightly as a threat because, of course, Andy Burnham has been like, look, you're going to ruin our party. And now Angela Rayner has come out and been like, no, you are going to ruin our party. And Keir Starmer, the managerial technocrat, so I don't care.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're 3 years away from the extinction of the Labour Party. I mean, I'm glad his threat radar is fully turned on here.
Yeah, absolutely. He's really defended himself well. And so now Angela Rayner has come out to attack him as well. And so you've got the factions breaking apart and revealing themselves as enemies. And so it's like, okay, well, what's and then the question that the Labour Party needs to ask itself is, what is this party for?
Well, the Labour Party?
Yeah. What is the point of the Labour Party?
London lawyers?
Well, no. That's the Starmer faction.
Right.
But that's not the Andy Burnham, Angela Rayner faction.
Well, what do they think then?
Well, they're the ones who think that the Gorton and Denton North white working class, they're the people who were offering them patronage, right? Historically, they were the patrons of the white working class in the North.
Yes.
That's the side of the party they come from. So they should be looking out for their interests when it comes to whatever the central government is doing.
If you're reliant on the support of the white working class, probably best not to spend 30 years trying to eradicate them off the map and replace them.
Well, that's exactly the problem they have. They brought in a massive constituency of foreigners who seem to hate the white working class.
Who are replacing them and raping their wives and daughters.
Privileged them over the white working class. And are now like, why have you, you know...
Why have you abandoned us?
Why have you abandoned us to reform? Yes. And now those foreigners, because their patronage is not basically enough, are like, well, we're going to abandon you for the Greens. And so the question now, if the white working class are fleeing to reform, or at least, you know, half of them are, and the Muslims are going to the Greens, well, what's the point of the Labour Party? Like, Rayner's faction has basically been drained out, and Starmer doesn't have an organic constituency out of SW1 outside of that.
I'm very much assuming this is a rhetorical question you don't actually want an answer from.
Well, I don't know. Like, what's the actual answer? Who is the Labour Party
for? I'm not
going
to give you one because I can't think of one.
Well, exactly. And so they're like, well,
say in the comments if you can think of a reason Labour should exist.
No, that's literally it. What's the narrative for the Labour Party? And Keir Starmer's only narrative is, I'm going to save Blairism, is basically what he's arguing. And so, unsurprisingly, it's looking like the Labour Party are going to be decimated in the May elections. And I mean, just brutal. As you can see, the white working class going to reform there, but the Greens getting the migrant vote. This is a prediction, not a statement of evidence yet. But as you can see, this is just brutal. Like, the Conservatives and Lib Dems aren't changing that much.
Yeah, right?
The Conservatives are for retirees in the southeast. The Lib Dems are for retirees and middle-class people in the southwest. But the Labour Party are just for nobody.
So Labour, they're starting with whatever it was, 2,300 councils, and they're losing 1,700 of them.
Remember, last year they lost a bunch too. So the elections are staggered across
the
country.
But the scale of that loss, you could fight a medieval battle and have fewer losses, even if you lost.
Oh, you definitely would.
Yeah.
You definitely would. You'd lose like 30 or 40% of your army if you lost the battle.
I mean, that is...
that's a crushing defeat. The Romans lost something similar to that when Hannibal defeated them at Cannae.
Right.
It was genuinely like they fielded something like 90,000 men, 86,000 men, and Hannibal killed or captured somewhere in the region of 50,000 to 60,000 of them.
I mean, that would still be a good outcome for Labour.
Yeah, that would be better than this outcome.
Yes.
That's correct. This would be a worse defeat than the Romans at Cannae.
I mean, it's a terrible shame this has happened to Labour and the Conservatives as well, but I just kind of wish they didn't need to destroy our country in order to get the comeuppance that they deserve.
I've got no... Yeah, exactly. I'm terribly sympathetic, frankly. So the question is, literally, like I said, who is Labour for? And the answer seems to be the rich.
Yes,
we covered this before.
I can absolutely believe that.
Well, as you can see, the comfortably well-off are most voting for Labour. So it's the rich people who are benefiting from the system, the people who are getting... one of the complaints that's constantly being levelled is... in fact, was it Nigel Farage who said this the other day, saying, like, well, you've got in the quangos... there are something like 2,000... Oh, it was Jemrick who said this in the press conference the other day. There are more than 2,000 people in quangos earning more than 100 grand a year. It's like, yeah, and they're voting Labour. Like, they know how their bread is buttered. And so, like, they're just about coping. Look at the other side. Financially precarious, just about coping. And financially stable, incidentally, reform. Right?
I remember when I was living in London earlier on, and this was when UKIP was still a thing. I think it was UKIP I was doing this for. I was doing some door knocking in election time. And I was able to work out fairly quickly. I could look at a house and see straight away who they're going to voting for. If it was a smaller house, a bit run down, UKIP. If it was a bigger house with a BMW in the driveway, every time I knew it was going to be Labour. And I'd knock on the door, and I started getting so curious, I would try and strike up a conversation with them. Every single time, it was a top-end civil servant, NHS executive, it was stuff like that. All the people who got money in this country who are not Labour, half of them have already left the country. They've fled already. So the comfortably well-off in this country are the senior party, the apparatchiks.
Yep. They're the people who know the system is working for me, which is why I'm comfortably well off. Because if you didn't need the system to work for you and made yourself comfortably well off, why have you stayed?
Yes.
And everyone else, even the financially stable, are like, God, I need the system to change. Because even the financially stable are like, okay, but look at my bills. Look at the immigration. Look at all of these things. Look at the prices of houses. My God, something needs changing. Even though I might be doing well now, I can look down the line and be like, oh God, this is going to get worse. And of course, if you're, you know, precarious, you're like, I just wish I had a country that worked for me, that prioritized me in some way, right? Mm. So this is who the Labour Party seems to be for. I thought we'd finish on just something mildly humorous, actually.
Well then.
Which is weird. Starmer's been racking up a bunch of wins recently.
Yes. Yes, he has.
It's funny.
I don't like talking about it because, you know, obviously I want him to fail in every way that a man can fail.
Obviously.
But yeah.
But he has. I mean, the Iran stuff was the most interesting thing because I honestly thought he would just be a complete party man on this.
And he looked at it straight in a way and was like, well, how are you possibly going to win this? What's your objective? No.
Yeah.
Why would we get involved in that?
And he eventually has sent HMS Dragon.
Oh, it won't work.
It won't work. It means one ship.
It'll probably sink by the time it gets there. But.
Probably. I mean, we are just not in a position to fight a long-range war. And so this is one of those takes and one of those decisions that's going to age better as time goes on.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Almost certainly.
Absolutely. But the next one is net migration, actually. The Labour left can stamp their feet all they want, but Starmer has actually brought that down very significantly from the Tories. So he has a Trump card over not just the Conservatives, but the Conservatives in Nigel Farage's party who were part of the government that made the Boris wave happen.
Excellent point.
He has a Trump card over them saying, you were there. Were the administrator, your immigration minister.
Thank goodness he is so completely soulless and devoid of any sort of sense of human normality. Because if he had even a glimmer of that, what he could make of his successes, if he had the hint of personality. But no, for him it is all process and the rules and following the procedures. So he doesn't get any benefit. But I mean, he is outperforming most of Nigel Farage's shadow cabinet.
Yes. I mean, honestly, if you were to choose between what Jemrick did in his time, and that was about there.
That was the bit going up.
Yeah, that was a bit going up.
Yeah.
And Keir Starmer
is the bit going down.
Which is like literally this bit here.
Yeah.
Well, you'd have to choose Keir Starmer just on the numbers.
Mm.
Now, this isn't great either, right? Just to be clear, net immigration going to 200,000 sounds good.
Well, only when you've been at 1.3 million.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially as the gross immigration is 850,000. It's just you get about 400,000 foreigners leaving every year and 250,000 British people leaving.
Mm.
So the churn is dreadful. This, you know, this isn't immigration has been solved or anything like that.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is in the realm of arguing in the Commons, well, Keir Starmer has got a Trump card that he can just slap down on the table.
Yeah, doesn't use it, though.
Yeah, sometimes he does, actually. He can be quite aggressive in the comments, actually. So sometimes he does, and he'll say, I'm not going to listen to you, shut up, to Jemrick or whoever challenged him, right? He can just slap them with these things, and he does. So this is another Starmer win, unfortunately. You know, unfortunately, obviously, I'm glad that fewer people are coming in. But
I'll give you that. Let's keep it quiet, though.
Yeah.
Don't tell anyone.
The next one is Mauritius, weirdly enough, and the Chagos Islands deals. Now,
how is that a win?
Yeah, that's a great question. How is that a win, right?
Yeah.
Now, I don't think that Starmer's playing 4D chess, right?
Right?
And if he was playing 4D chess, why did he choose Mauritius as the enemy, right? Because there's a really great question of why are you just paying them to take the Chagos Islands? Like, what was all this? Well, you know, in 2014, there was an opinion given in some international court that it would be nice if Mauritius had the Chagos Islands.
I found a rule.
It wasn't even rules. It was an advisory judgment or something like that, right?
Yeah, right.
And so he's just dived in with both feet.
Okay.
But the thing is, he seems to have destroyed the Mauritian government because they expected, this is in this Bloomberg article, right? They expected 10 billion rupees of extra spending.
And they went out and spent it before they got it.
It's in the budget. And then Trump was like, no, we're not doing that.
Oh, brilliant.
And so, without doing anything, Keir Starmer has sunk the government of Mauritius. Now, I don't know why.
That is brilliant.
Are we playing some devilish 4D chess grandmaster game against Mauritius? Probably not.
But I mean, I suppose there's the pure joy of messing with the Mauritians, but there probably wasn't that. But
if they were the French, then fair enough. But
we came along and said, look, we are definitely going to give you 10 billion gibs.
Yes.
And they were like, brilliant, let's spend it.
Yes.
And now Trump comes along and says, no, you're not giving them gibs, and their government is collapsing because they haven't got the gibs. I mean, there's a lesson here, isn't there?
There is.
There is a lesson here with our own internal Gibbs community, but we might want to learn at some point.
Mm. There is. Anyway, just, you know, small thing.
Marvellous.
And these little wins are not including him basically keeping control of his own party. Like, he's got an iron fist over his party.
Oh, yes.
He's got control of the internals. He managed to kill...
He's about as close to Stalin as you're allowed to be in 2026.
Yeah, yeah. Again, you know, like him or lump him, he's managed to do these things. And so the next thing is his approval rating, which is, of course, as bad as you know, but it's actually slightly up. It was 15% recently, and it's gone to 18% with his disapproval at 73%. So, I mean, you know, like you say, he's not good at messaging, really. But another strange win is that people actually view him as the most capable person in the country to be the prime minister. Now, it's not by much.
When you phrase it like that, and the alternative is Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage, I can see how they've got to that conclusion.
And also, just think about, like, Kemi Badenoch does the same sort of political stunts. Like, so the way things work, you've got the Green Party, who do their stupid political stunts, but they let the activists do that, right?
Yeah.
You know, Hannah from Gorton and Denton, all that. They're the clowns, but Zach Polanski presents himself as if he's living in the 1970s, but that's fine, right? And then you've got the Reform Party, which is the Butlins' holiday party, doing these stupid big stunts. And then you have Kemi Badenoch's Conservatives, who follow everyone else's stupid stunt with a crappier stunt of their own. And then you've got Keir Starmer, who's the only person not doing stunts. He's the only person in the circus who isn't dressed like a clown.
I mean, if you're not prompting for Nigel Farage, for Rupert Lowe, I can understand how they got to this.
I mean, Rupert Lowe's only been in the game of party leadership for a month, so let's give him a break on that.
Yeah.
But Keir Starmer, he's the only one not doing stunts. He's the only one not messing around.
What odds would you have to see to put a tenner on Keir Starmer winning the next election?
I don't know, but I think his coalition is too broken.
Yeah.
I don't think he can pull together a coalition. I think
it is.
I've been saying I think this is the last Labour government ever, right? But so I think the coalition's gone. I think the minority...
But still, what you're painting a picture here clearly is we've got every party is a incoherent mess. Exactly. I mean, British politics is just a shambles.
Absolutely. So there is all to play for. Right. And if Keir Starmer is thought of by the public as the best man, the most capable prime minister, well, I mean, I guess it's a good thing he's in charge then, isn't it? You know, but it goes to show you that the kind of spectacle politics that everyone else is engaging in isn't cutting through. It's not cutting through. People are not after spectacle politics. Otherwise, I mean, how Nigel Farage is below Keir Starmer. It's always easier to be in opposition.
Yeah.
If Nigel Farage was just coming out sort of grim-faced saying, listen, folks, this is what's happened. I'm not happy about it. This is what we're going to do to fix it. Just wait until the next election. Trust me on this. We're going to get this done. Why would he not be ahead of Keir Starmer, the most hated man in the world?
Yeah.
Right? Just literally everyone hates Keir Starmer. And yet still they're like, yeah, he'd probably be more competent.
I mean, at some point, Nigel Farage is going to have to do substance. But he's just allergic to it. I don't know why.
I just think he's made his bed now and he's going to have to lie in it. But but anyway, so yeah, basically everyone is scrambling for a narrative, as you said earlier. Right, there are no good narratives for any of the parties that are currently occupying the middle, the main area in politics.
Yeah.
Nigel Farage doesn't know who he's trying to serve and failed on that in the Gordon and Denton. The Labour Party has had an internal collapse and isn't really a coalition party for anyone.
And the wins that it does have, it doesn't like to talk about.
Exactly. It's ashamed of talking about, actually. And so the ground is as fertile as it's ever been. And as you said, Rupert Lowe is on the up. So